actually in a really good place teaching the younger ones because they're kind of closer in age than an adult. So it often actually helps them learn.
Interesting. Some really interesting perspectives. Thank you both so much for joining us this evening. Lisa Owen, Susan Wildig and Dr. Carol Campbell there. Love to hear your thoughts and experiences on this. Get in touch with the programme tonight, 08085 909 693 or the text 85058. The update is on the way.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. President Biden has said the United States will do everything in its power to prevent an escalation of conflict in the Middle East. Cross-border exchanges of fire between the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group in Lebanon and the Israeli military have intensified. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, explained what Israel's next steps might be.
It seems absolutely set on this path of escalation at the moment. They have reinforced their forces on the border and people are talking that maybe the next stage or a few stages ahead could be a ground operation sending in troops and tanks into Lebanon.
The issue of private donations such as free clothing and holidays overseas has continued to plague Keir Starmer on the first day of the Labour conference in Liverpool. The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, said she understood why some people were angry, but she insisted the government had followed the rules. Baroness Hodge, who was a Labour MP for nearly 30 years, says the issue has become a distraction.
I know Keir well. He's not a Boris Johnson. He's not somebody who acts with impunity. And I think he will be as devastated as everybody else that this went wrong. But they've stopped it. And I think this is the moment that we bring forward really, really clear, strong proposals to clean up politics, to set the rules, to ensure they're properly enforced and to ensure proper accountability to the public.
A second man has been arrested in connection with the kidnap of an 87-year-old man in Oldham. The pensioner was reportedly dragged into a car and attacked as he was being driven around while demands were made for his money. He was eventually dumped in West Yorkshire. The left-wing opposition candidate, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, has won Sri Lanka's presidential election after an historic second round of counting. He has promised voters tough anti-corruption measures and to revive the economy. Manchester City are at the top of the Premier League table after a 2-2 draw against Arsenal at the Etihad. Arsenal played the second half with 10 men but were holding on to their lead until John Stones scored in the 98th minute. The Manchester City manager, Pep Guardiola, had praise for the Arsenal defence.
They put four players in line, so incredible toll, incredible commitment. I think we are not able to do that as a team. So big compliment from Arsenal because they defend every single ball, every single block until the end, you know.
Neil Robertson has won the English Snooker Open, battling Wu Yeatser 9-7. It was Robertson's first final in more than 2 years. The Princess Royal has laid a wreath of poppies at the Oosterbeek War Cemetery in the Netherlands for soldiers who fought in one of the most daring battles of the Second World War. Operation Market Garden involved hundreds of Allied troops parachuting into Nazi-occupied land. Princess Anne joined veterans and family for a ceremony at the site where nearly 2,000 soldiers are buried. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 11.
On Radio 4. The more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, good evening. Just gone 3 minutes past 11. It is Johnny in for Stephen Nolan this evening. And tonight on the show, we've heard views from Liverpool, where Labour are meeting for the first time since their general election victory. But with rumblings of discontent over so-called freebie gates, will that detract from the party's core message of renewal? Here's what two-party members Liam and Chris told me.
I think if this is the biggest news that we've got, then hopefully we've got a bright future ahead of us. And that's not to disparage how important it is to some people about the winter fuel payment, particularly the people who are £2, £3, £4 over. The blunt instrument of government is never, never helpful. And that's actually why the conversation about devolved government is a really important one, because, you know, you can talk about means tested or not, but I think that we all know that what we really want is power closer to where we live.
And look, I agree with what Liam's saying about the mood. It is really optimistic, you know, and And we talk to these ministers, and they all say the same thing. It's that tough decisions need to be made.
Well, we've also been talking about fussy eating. What is it that determines why some foods are a definite no-no to some children?
It's actually really good that children are really cautious about what they put in their mouths. We often, as parents, complain that children don't eat stuff. But frankly, you know, if they're a four-year-old going through the world, you probably wish they wouldn't put as much stuff in their mouths as they actually do. So a little bit of caution around that is really naturally quite healthy.
So your stories of fussy eating, please, 85058. Johnny, I cannot eat raw tomato. If I do, it comes straight back up. Nice. Possibly because it's the same plant family as the deadly nightshade. John in Bedford, thank you, John. 85058 for your fussy eating stories. Also, just before the news, we were talking about homeschooling. Please do get in touch with us if you've got any experience in this area. I'd love to hear from you. If you're currently trying to homeschool at the moment, I take my hat off to you, by the way. Or likewise, perhaps you were homeschooled yourself. Get in touch with the programme, 85058. Among the headlines you'll be waking up to in the morning, Metro red flags at Labour conference. The I, Reeves, not to return to austerity as Labour faces winter fuel revolt. And in the Express, even Labour's union backers want fuel cuts scrapped. This is a show that's all about your calls and you getting in touch with us. Here's how to do it.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Plus, see our privacy notice. bbc.co.uk/5live.
BBC Radio 5 Live. The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Johnny Iamson.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
I'm going to take this time now to return to a story which has dominated the news agenda in recent days. The growing catalogue of sexual abuse allegations levelled against the former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. Harrods current owners say they're utterly appalled by the allegations of abuse perpetrated by Mohammed Al-Fayed. The company says it has separate compensation schemes in place for ex-employees who say they were attacked by him. Bruce Drummond joins us, who's one of the barristers representing the survivors. Thanks very much for being with us, Bruce.
Not at all. Pleasure. Bruce, whatever we can to bring this story to the attention of the public.
Yeah, just tell us a little bit about how and why you've got involved in this.
Yeah, of course. I got involved with the producer of the documentary that recently was aired on BBC, Al-Fayed the Predator. And during the course of that, I was asked if I'd like to speak to one of the victims as she was looking for some representation. I happily did that. And I have to say that having spoken to her, I was absolutely infuriated and distressed at the story that she told me about what happened at Harrods. Mm. And from then on, I was just fully engrossed in the case. And now we've expanded and we have a big team and we've got... we've got 37 of the victims currently signed up, or survivors, I like to call them. And we've had, since the documentary, a further 120 inquiries.
Obviously, Mohammed Al-Fayed is dead. And the company has also been sold. So it's not under the Al-Fayed ownership anymore. So where do you stand with liability and responsibility if the current owners were not those there when Mohammed Al-Fayed was carrying out his alleged crimes?
Sure. It's owned now by the Qatari state. And that answer is quite simple, really. When you buy a company, no matter what it is, any company, you take on... effectively, the responsibilities of that company. When you buy it, you have a duty to carry out what we call in law due diligence. Due diligence means that at the time that Harrods was sold in 2010, the new owners should have or ought to have known about the various outstanding claims that existed against the company. The company still is the same company. It's still Harrods. That hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
All that's changed is the ownership. But because of a law we have here called successor in title, companies take over the liabilities of the previous companies. It is absolutely inconceivable to us that they were unaware or had no idea about what was going on before, given the fact that it's been in TV documentaries, it's been on Channel 4 in a documentary, there have been complaints, there was a lawsuit with Vanity Fair. And it's just absolutely, in our view, at the liability falls at the feet of the new owners because they failed to carry out due diligence when they bought it, and the company failed to implement a safe system of work to protect their employees, which was the duty of the company at the time that these ladies were assaulted.
If people watch the documentary, at the conclusion of the documentary, there was a long statement from Harrods effectively accepting
responsibility yeah.
and that they encouraged victims to get in touch with them because there is a scheme in place where they will deal with them and presumably try and compensate them. What is the matter with that in terms of trying to offer
some... exactly what the matter is. That is, firstly, obviously, anybody who has been a victim of this horrific regime. And I pause there for a second just to say that this system that was in place was horrific. Al-Fayed was a monster. And there is no question about that. The system that was in place, it started at the very top of this company. And involved recruiting girls of a certain look, interviewing them, sending them for a very intrusive gynecological examination, which has distressed many, many of the ladies. A system of grooming by Fayed and leading on to what we'll call serious sexual assaults in varying degrees. Some women were had worse assaults than others, but some of it was horrific. And if you saw the documentary, you'll see one girl was 15 when she was raped by Fayed. Another girl was 16, raped multiple times by Fayed. It is absolutely horrific. In principle, anybody who is a victim or anybody who has a claim is entitled to go where they want to get redress for that injury. However, our concerns about what Harrods is trying to do, it's a bit like marking your own homework. Because Harrods are the main offenders, and they're saying, well, come to us and we'll make it right for you. Now, a lot of ladies that we act for and have come to us over the past few days in their masses, found that very uncomfortable. They found it very, very uncomfortable and somewhat insulting that the company that's actually carried out the harm is going to assess the damage for them.
Right.
And so they want, and they're entitled to, in my view, independence, regardless of who it doesn't have to be us, whoever it is. They're entitled to independent advice and independent representation when it comes to assessing the horrific injuries. Also, don't forget, when we talk about injury and we talk about assaults, you have to look at it in the broader context of the past 20 years and the suffering that these ladies have suffered over the past 20 years. Some of them have ended up in psychiatric institutes. Some of them have been unable to form relationships with anybody ever again. It's been absolutely very, very distraught and horrific story that they're all saying.
And Bruce, this is so. I mean, is there any way of criminal culpability in this, or is this a civil case that you're undertaking?
We are undertaking a civil case. Now, that doesn't say that there isn't any criminal culpability, but that really is a matter more for the police and the various investigative authorities and not one for us.
Right. And what I don't know this because I can't seem to recall from the documentary. I don't know if they spoke about any that had gone to Harrods and actually had been through this process and whether they paid any compensation or anything like that. But if there are victims of the alleged crimes that have gone through that and gone to Harrods themselves, does that preclude them from going through this civil action with you?
We say no. And for a number of reasons. If anybody's been through a process, first of all, and they've had to enter into an NDA, and that NDA was effectively for them to keep quiet about any sexual assault, which would have been a criminal offence, we say that that doesn't hold water.
Right.
And also, it's quite a complicated issue because you also have to look at the actual agreements they had, the levels of compensation, whether they were right or not, what advice they had at the time. And, you know, a number of factors, Johnny. I'm not trying to be evasive.
No, sure. But as you, from your perspective, you think they can, but I presume Harrods may have a different one, but that's...
Well, they might do, but really, you know, do they want to go down that road? Is that a good road for them to do?
What is justice in this instance, Bruce? If they've already admitted liability or responsibility, what does justice look like apart from... The financial ramifications for the victims?
Yeah, I have to say, just looking at that financial side of it, of the 37 ladies that have already retained us, and of the numerous phone calls and inquiries we're doing with every minute almost at the moment, not one woman has ever said to me, "What do you think my claim's worth?"
Right.
It's never been an issue. It's never been mentioned. What they want more than anything else is accountability. They want to feel safe to be able to tell their stories after all these years of having to keep them secret because they were so terrified, Johnny, honestly. They were threatened. They were threatened by the security at Harrods following the dismissal of them. That they, you know, that things like we know where your family live. And putting that into context, these were often very young girls. And as you've heard, some were only 15. And average age is between 19 and 24 of a certain type of look. Coming to London for the first time, no family, nobody to turn to, and being absolutely terrified. And so it's for them. What they've said so far, justice for them is that they want, A, to be able to tell their story without fear or threat, for the people that have harmed them to be accountable for what they've done. And I have to say a huge thank you to the world's press. And that's why I'm speaking to you at 11:30 on a Sunday night, because I'm going to do everything I can to help these girls.
Why?
And
sorry, carry on.
Yeah, sorry. So that they have their accountability and that the those who have harmed them are brought to the public attention. And also, finally, what they want is for it to change, hopefully, the way corporations behave towards their staff. To get the message out there, out really into the public, that this is just not right. Just because you're big, you're powerful, you cannot, you know, hide, conceal and abuse young girls.
And
that's the message.
In the documentary, there is testimony from victims about how they were intimidated by people from within Harrods, but also there is, you know, talk about the behaviour of the Met Police as well. What is the context of that organisation in this, and what could happen to them?
That's a very interesting question again. I mean, obviously, we weren't there. We didn't act for them at the time, so we don't know what evidence the Met Police had at the time to go on, et cetera, regarding these prosecutions. It does strike us, and I say us because we're a team, including Gloria Allred, that it was a very strange decision not to pursue that 15-year-old girl that was raped by Fayyad when she made the complaint, and the CPS decided there wasn't sufficient evidence to prosecute. And she was told it's because she got one of the dates wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, realistically, a 15-year-old girl raped at one of the most prestigious stores in the world by the CEO and a billionaire, and she gets a date wrong? Really? Mm. But, I mean, I don't know. I'm not privy to the evidence, so I can't really comment.
Sure.
But from what they have told us, I am commenting. Mm. And from what they have told us, that seems a very strange decision.
Just finally, Bruce, you know, it is sadly unsurprising that we are yet again talking about a man in a position of great power and influence and wealth abusing women. You know, this is a perpetual story, sadly, isn't it?
It's a perpetual story, Johnny.
There will be those who are reminded of the likes of Jimmy Savile. And when that story started to unravel, there was an avalanche of women that came forward.
Yeah, that's right.
You have mentioned 37 survivors, but have been approached by up to 150. How big do you think this is going to be?
Well, I think if you look at it in context, key threads to take are that nearly all the women say about him being effectively a prolific predator, obsessive. He had a rule over Harrods for 25 years. And there seems to have been no let up in his behaviour. And don't forget, he was there, he owned it with his brothers, Salah and Ali. I think Ali's still alive in Connecticut. But that's one for more for the Americans. But the actual responsibility there has been there for 25 years. And it's just on a simple mathematical calculation, you could be into an awful lot more ladies who've been harmed.
Okay. Bruce, thanks ever so much for your candour and for being with us tonight. I appreciate that. And thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you, Johnny, for helping these ladies.
No, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks very much. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Bruce Drummond there. For more on the story, head to the BBC iPlayer, where you can find the documentary Al Fayyad Predator at Harrods. It's uncomfortable, but it is really important viewing. Don't forget, if you've been affected by what you've heard, you can find sources of information and support by going to the BBC Action Line pages. Just search for BBC Action Line. 22 minutes past 11, it is Johnny in for Stephen on this Sunday night, and the government in England is planning the biggest reimagining of the NHS in its history. One plan is to offer health tests and scans in shopping centres, football stadiums and local high streets. The government plans to use innovation and technology to cut down on waiting times. As an example, Barnsley Shopping Centre, the Glassworks, has a NHS diagnostic centre providing ultrasounds, x-rays and breast screening scans. Virtual wards using apps and remote monitoring will provide hospital-level care at home. I've been speaking to the GP and health commentator, Dr. Sarah Jarvis, and asked her what she made of remote and DIY healthcare.
We've moved a lot towards reducing health inequalities because we know that, unfortunately, there's a bit of an inverse care law out there. So basically, the more people need screening and healthcare, the less likely they are to be able to access it. And screening is a classic example of that. A lot of people who really do need, whether it's lung screening, whether it's breast screening, etc., maybe screening for osteoporosis, thinning of the bones, find it very difficult to access, to take time off, to get into a screening centre and so on. So by having screening centres where people are going to be anyway, the idea is that you can make it easier for them to access without having to take extra time off work, without needing them to take two or three buses to get there. And overall, when you look at the results, you know, increasing the uptake of breast screening in the Glassworks in Barnsley by nearly 50%,
wow,
that's got to be good news.
Wow. So this is obviously part of an issue to make it easier for patients to seek access, but also take the strain away from the NHS. Does this mean, in a way, we have to accept that the NHS can't cope without these interventions and more of them being brought in?
Well, the example you've given actually isn't about reducing work on the NHS, because these are all NHS teams who are doing the screening. And one of the biggest problems we've got is that we find it very difficult to get the key staff who need to interpret the results. So, for instance, there's a real shortage of radiologists. However, where radiology is concerned, actually breast screening, there's a couple of recent studies which have been done in Sweden, I think, showing that, in fact, by using not two radiologists to double-check results, but one AI to look at results of mammograms and a radiologist then to check it, to check what the AI has found, that actually it's just as accurate. It doesn't increase the number of cancers that are missed. And perhaps equally importantly, it doesn't increase the number of so-called false positives. So in other words, a lot of people being called forward, told they might have something wrong when they haven't got something wrong, which can gum up the works. Mm. So actually, that's a really good example of where AI in the future could get over this sticking point, which is the lack of qualified doctors and specialists to do the work.
Do you think, though, that, I mean, considering I think now it's around a fifth of patients are waiting longer than the target time of 6 weeks, do you think that we are entering, this is a phrase that's been used so much, a new normal of people now just expecting of their wait time to be far longer than what it should be and actually just putting up with illnesses and therefore some people actually not seeking to get them treated anyway?
That's always a concern. Now, there are lots of different targets. I'm not sure which one you're referring to as a six-week target. We used to have what was called a two-week wait target for people. If I referred somebody because I thought they might have cancer, then the target used to be that they had to be seen within 2 weeks. However, there are that shifted slightly, and it's now more focused on they need to get the tests done and they need to get the treatment started in a certain length of time. There's no question that people are waiting too long. There's absolutely clear that people are waiting too long. But of course, part of the problem is that we've got more and more pressure in general practice. We've got 1,800 fewer GPs than we had in 2005, I think it was, 2015. So we've lost 1,800 GPs. And at the same time, we've got patients who are needing more and more help because waiting times are so long. You kind of get into a vicious cycle. The more people aren't having their treatments, the more people are coming back into general practice because they're still suffering, and therefore the longer the waiting times.
What do you think of the idea of what we've seen in the glassworks, for instance, being put in football stadiums, local high streets, which I know that you can go to your local high street on certain days in certain places and get certain tests, but then becoming a permanent fixture? Can you see that happening, and can you see people being happy to use them?
I'd really like to see more availability of tests which are already being offered on the NHS. So we are not talking about people who aren't eligible for the tests. In fact, funnily enough, I was having a mammogram about 6 weeks ago, routine breast screening, and somebody walked in, and mine was actually in a mobile centre in a supermarket car park. And it was really convenient for me. I went in, I was waiting to have it done, and somebody walked in and said, can anybody have a mammogram? Because I've got this problem with my breast. And the receptionist had to say, no, this is only if you've got an appointment. You need to go and see the GP first.
Right.
Now, we can't have people referring themselves, for instance, thinking they've got cancer. Not because we want to get in the way of that, but because what would happen would be that the whole system would be completely overwhelmed. I would reckon that for every patient I see who's convinced they've got cancer, who does turn out to have what I call red flags, which mean that they do need to be seen urgently, there are probably, 50 people who are worried they've got cancer but actually don't have any so-called red flags. Mm. And if everybody referred themselves, then the queues would be so long that the people who did have cancer would never get seen.
The problem is, Dr. Jarvis, there'll be loads of people screaming at the radio saying, but I just can't even get an appointment with my GP.
I completely understand that. But unfortunately, we've got 84% of locum GPs who say they can't get work because practices can't afford to employ them. We've got 1,800 fewer GPs than we had in 2015. So the GPs we have got are working harder and harder and harder. And unfortunately, I don't know a GP who's working a less than 12-hour day. When you go in, you expect to be working solidly for 12 hours for one day. And yet we just never seem to be able to get to the front of the queue.
Mm. So is that where, though, and I know you mentioned about the glassworks, for instance, not necessarily being about trying to reduce waiting times and improve the amount of people that can be seen, but that is where the government is quite clearly turning to innovation and technology and AI down the line to try and cut waiting times.
Yes, I think some of it is trying to cut waiting times. But again, you know, those scans have still got to be interpreted. So we've still got to have people who can interpret them. One of the biggest problems we've got is so-called bed blocking, people who are medically fit to be discharged from hospital, but there is nowhere in social care to take them when they get out. And as long as that goes on, people are going to continue to have their operations cancelled. So we've really got to look at the whole system in a joined up way.
Mm, it's a slight tangent to what we're talking about, but I think a valid one anyway, because of the waiting lists, people using technology in a DIY sense to try and either diagnose themselves or treat themselves. Dr. Google, for instance, and there are loads of apps out there as well, which can measure your heart rate. We've got various bits of technology now that track your blood sugars, for instance, in the home kits you could buy. Do you worry, though, that can lead to people misdiagnosing and mistreating themselves?
Yes, I absolutely do. I'm afraid Dr. Google can be very misleading sometimes. You can use, of course, there are reliable ways of doing it. So, for instance, patient.info, all their articles are written for patients, for patients by GPs. So they are specifically, you can guarantee them. If you go onto the NHS, you can put in your symptoms and it will lead you through asking all the questions that a doctor would ask. And that's very, very different to looking for Dr. Google and bringing something up. Unfortunately, very often you'll find things that, you know, seem too good to be true. And of course, if things seem too good to be true, I'm afraid they often are. And that's often the case where my patients come in saying, oh, I've read about this solution. It's a miracle for the condition I've got.
Yeah. Likewise as well, it can be the opposite end of absolutely terrifying when it turned out to be something that you don't need to worry about in any way. Just to conclude then, Sarah, it sounds very much like it is a combination of technology, but it will always be reliant on people power as well. You know, we know the incredible job that the NHS does, and we know how exponentially smart AI is becoming, but it will always need the eyes of a trained practitioner to work out exactly what is happening and what needs to be done to treat you.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, it's very much dependent on what you put in. Garbage in, garbage out. We've got her, for instance, on patient.info, there is a symptom checker. And if you just put in sore throat and swollen glands, then the first thing it's going to come up with is not a strep throat. It's not tonsillitis. It's something like Viles disease. So you have to put in lots and lots of symptoms. And that's where technology can be incredibly clever. So AI, for instance, can take all these very rare symptoms and put them together because it doesn't forget. We might have learned about it at medical school, but if it's a very rare condition that I've never heard of, then I may well never have seen it in my medical career, and therefore chances are that it won't be top of my mind. So I think that's where things like AI can really be helpful.
Okay. Dr. Sarah Jarvis, thank you very much for being with us. Nice to talk to you this evening.
Thanks very much.
She's great. Really, really good. Love speaking to Dr. Jarvis. Right, on the way, we'll have a bit of a post-mortem about Anthony Joshua's fight last night, losing to the brilliant Daniel Dubois. What next for Big AJ? And also we're going to talk about the Homeless World Cup currently taking place in Seoul. Fascinating competition. A couple of people involved in that on the way. Right now, let's get the latest update that comes from Andy Barwell.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And the issue of private donations has clouded day one of the Labour conference in Liverpool. The Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner says she understands why some people are angry, but insists that the government followed the rules and has been transparent. President Biden says the US will do all it can to prevent what he calls a wider war in the Middle East. The UN says that the latest attacks between Israel and Hezbollah have brought the Middle East to the brink of an imminent catastrophe. The Justice Secretary says she's furious that some prisoners have been released early without ankle tags. Shabana Mahmood has been demanding answers from the prison's contractor Serco and says the company could face penalties. Well, on to the sports news now. Mikel Arteta felt it was a miracle his Arsenal side were in the lead for so long with 10 men at the Etihad Stadium. Leandro Trossard was sent off for two yellow cards in first half added time. But there was a 98th minute equaliser for Manchester City in this clash between these Premier League title rivals.
Shot from Kovacic, that's blocked!
Well, this was the reaction of the City boss Pep Guardiola to his side claiming a point from the game.
It's better than defeat. We prefer to win. We start really well. Many things happen in the game. Many things happen in the game. But yeah, we handle it good. And at the end, we can rescue a point.
2-2 was also the result in the game between Brighton and Nottingham Forest. Jack Hinshelwood and Danny Welbeck were on target for Brighton. Chris Wood and Ramon Sosa scored for Forest. But Hinshelwood believed that his team deserved to win.
You know, I think it's frustrating that we haven't come away from with 3 points, especially we've gone down early and showed great character to get back into the game and be leading at 2-1 at half time. And, you know, from that position, we need to stop dropping points at home and be more resilient, harder to beat if we can't find that third goal. We're unbeaten, but we know the last two games we could have 6 points rather than two.
Well, one game in the Championship today, Preston North End forward Milutin Osmijic could face a lengthy ban after he appeared to bite Owen Beck during their goalless draw against Blackburn Rovers. Celtic defeated Falkirk 5-2 in the Scottish League Cup in the draw for the semi-finals. It's Celtic against Aberdeen, Motherwell against the holders Rangers. In today's Women's Super League action, Manchester City drew 2-2 with Arsenal. It ended one apiece between Liverpool and Leicester, and Spurs defeated newcomers Crystal Palace 4-0. Lando Norris in the McLaren was a comfortable winner today of the Singapore Formula One Grand Prix. It means that Norris has cut Max Verstappen's lead at the top of the Drivers' Championship back to 52 points with 6 races left.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. You know, I had a couple of little moments in the middle, but it was well controlled, I think, otherwise. And the car was mega, so I could push. We were flying the whole race and yeah, at the end, could just chill. So it was a nice race, still tough. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
A 3-way playoff was needed to decide the outcome of the European Tour's PGA Championship at Wentworth. Correspondent Ian Carter reports.
A stunning and lengthy eagle putt at the second extra hole gave the American Billy Horschel victory over Rory McIlroy, who remains golf's nearly man after another frustrating defeat. McIlroy did have his chance. An eagle at the 17th in regulation play meant a birdie at the last would have been enough. But from the fairway, he hit a poor second and could only par. Tristan Lawrence also finished at 20 under, but the South African perished at the first extra hole. Horschel, who birdied the last to make the shootout, brilliantly held his nerve to win his second PGA title.
No play was possible at Trent Bridge for cricket's 50-over one-day cup final. Somerset against Glamorgan will go to a reserve day. Neil Robertson is snooker's English Open champion after winning his first final in 2 years. And in rugby union's premiership, George Ford kicked all the points for Sale Sharks in their narrow 12-11 success over Harlequins.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
Johnny Ianson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Thanks very much, Andy. Let's stick with sport then. 23 minutes to midnight. And a question for you. What next for Anthony Joshua? That is the question on many lips after last night's comprehensive defeat at Wembley by fellow British fighter Daniel Dubois, which of course was all on 5 Live. The two-time world heavyweight champion Joshua cut a forlorn figure as he was outfought and outthought by Dubois, who was defending his IBF world heavyweight title. It was all over in 5 rounds after Joshua had been dropped to the canvas no fewer than 4 times. The big fight that night was introduced by music from Liam Gallagher.
Daniel Dubois reaches and lands a right hand once again, and he dips the knees of Anthony Joshua. AJ holding his chin up like a weather vane. Oh, counter right uppercut. The left hook buckled the knees of Anthony Joshua, and he's down for the second time. Referee Marcus McDonald allows the action to continue as Joshua gets back up to his feet, but he's punched down to the canvas.
So the bell sounds to begin round number 4. And Daniel Dubois lands a left hook which deposits Anthony Joshua on the canvas for the third time in the contest. Anthony Joshua back into the breach, and he's in desperate trouble as Dubois barrels him over to the canvas once again. And Anthony Joshua moving as though he is wading through wet concrete. His feet appear leaden. His hands appear painfully slow. More clumping blows landing on the gloves and forearms of Anthony Joshua. And Anthony Joshua in the midst of a nightmare here at the National Stadium. Anthony Joshua called to Daniel Dubois to back up, and another right hand, and another right hand from Joshua, and a huge right uppercut. But during the course of an exchange, a blistering right hand had deposited Anthony Joshua on the canvas. The towel has come in, and this contest is over.
What a night, what a fight. Joining me to talk about this is Barry Jones, former WBO super featherweight and world champion. Hi, Barry, how are you?
I'm very well. I just got to say, Ronald McIntosh and Liam Gallagher, the collaboration we never knew we needed.
Nobody saw that one coming, did they?
Brilliant.
But, I mean, just on that, before we talk about the actual fight itself, Barry, you were there, you were ringside, you were there from mid-afternoon watching the whole thing get prepared and rehearse. What was it like as a spectacle?
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was just to see the, you know, the size of the magnitude of the event. Of course, you know, the rings, though, it's erected, but they're still doing the stuff around the scenes, making sure it's all correct, and they're putting the padding around the ropes. It's all quite exciting, but to see the stage as well, just, you know, just behind the ring, and Liam Gallagher rehearsing, which is lucky enough, I was lucky enough there to hear that, and try and take a photo, but I got security jumping all over me within a second of that, and so they're correct, of course. But yeah, it was that was pretty good. So we were all pretty pumped already for what was going to be a great night anyway, we hope. But what happened was fantastic. But and Liam Gallagher was also fantastic. You know, if anyone was hanging around in the late 80s, certainly the mid 90s when Oasis were at their peak, it was a special time for music goers, and they brought back a few memories when I used to have hair.
Yeah, I dare say, though, that Anthony Joshua won't be looking back with rose-tinted spectacles for what happened last night. Before we talk about him, though, I think we need to acknowledge Daniel Dubois. What a fight from the off. Outboxed. I mean, he outfought, he outclassed him. A lot of people, I would say, perhaps underestimating Dubois, but he proved so many people wrong last night.
Yeah, well, I think what sums it up is, which was the biggest shock. Like, Dubois knocking Joshua out is not a huge, he's an underdog, and no one, and everyone thought that Joshua would win. But Dubois knocking Joshua out is not a massive shock because he can punch, and they're big guys. But the way he bullied Joshua from literally as soon as the bell went, because I was sat, I had the best seat in the house. I'm literally, I could touch the canvas, I could touch the canvas, I'm that close. And while Michael Buffer's announcing the fighters, he's trying to look around Buffer to get eye contact with Joshua. He was ready to go from the offset. I mean, he was so confident. And for a man who's been criticised for his mental frailties, because, you know, because of the two defeats he's had where he has stayed on the floor and he possibly could have got up, then, you know, that was a bigger shock. That was a huge shock. And just the way he dominated. And we've been saying all week in the build-up, and there were shows on every channel about how, you know, we did loads of podcasts with BBC, me and Steve Burns, about how it was so important for either fighter to get the domination very early, and that was with the jab. They both got very good jabs. Different jabs, but good, solid jabs. And it was Dubois who took the centre of the ring and landed with a big, cutting jab first. And from there on, then, he was in control, and Joshua was a bit defensive, though loose defensive, you have to say, but he was always the guy trying to break in and couldn't get a look in.
It was so surprising, though, wasn't it? The 10-8 round after 10-8 round after 10-8 round, and then a knockdown almost every round. I think, like you said, you know, Dubois was so powerful that people could see a victory beforehand, but not in the way that it happened. And I wonder what you think maybe changed, because I'm reminded of when he fought Alexander Usyk, and afterwards Usyk was saying, you know, you've got a dream. It's boxing, not ballet. You can do this. Just keep believing in yourself. And that really lovely kind of aftermath of when he beat him. And what did he change? What has changed? Is it a mindset thing or is it a physical thing?
Yeah, it's all mental. He's always had the physical ability to do stuff. So he's been rigid at times. So the big guys aren't they? But I think the thing that was mental, because I think it was a fitness. He was wary of his fitness. Where little guys, because you have to go, you don't punch as hard. You have those war of attritions when you're an amateur boxer, you're three round wars, and you have it as a professional because not everything has that crazy power, but heavyweights are not afforded that luxury. They're knocking people out in two, three rounds in most fights if they're good. So they don't get to go through that barrier, or as marathon runners would say, you know, go through that wall for the second half of the race. And so once you go through, if you've never been there before, when you get really, really tired in a boxing match, the panic sets in because you know you're more vulnerable. And I think he's got, even with Joe Joyce, when he had the eye socket problem, he was hurt, but he was exhausted, and the panic was to stay on the floor. And against Usyk, when he did so well,
Yeah.
The pressure came on. He was really exhausted. And I think he just panicked and stayed on the knee and just didn't get up. And I think in the Jarrell Miller fight, the fight straight after the Alexander Usyk fight in Riyadh, something changed. I don't know whether it was a team or whatever, whatever work they did, he pushed through that. There was a moment there, he was exhausted. He pushed through it. And on the other side, there was a new reserve of fitness. And he realized that he could do it. Mm. So then when he boxed Hergovic at the fight before the Joshua fight, the tactics were awful in the first five rounds, but he bullied him because he just knew he had a good chin. He has a great chin. And then in the second half of the fight, he was so strong and fit. And now he has a self-belief that he can take a good shot. He's powerful and he's fit.
Yeah.
And he's light on his feet when he can be. And his hands are quite fast for a big, big fella. And so why wouldn't you believe in yourself? But I thought the crowd would overwhelm him. Mm. It's okay to say all those things I pointed out are great. But the difference between being a good fighter and a great fighter is coping with pressure.
Yeah.
There's no mistake. That wasn't a boxing fans crowd. That was an Anthony Joshua crowd.
Yeah.
It really was. That was an Anthony Joshua homecoming, and he coped with that pressure all through that ring walk. His eyes didn't move. They didn't move once. They focused right on the center. He couldn't wait to get in that ring. All was on his mind was, let's get the bell going. Let's get the fight started. I'm going to knock him out.
He is a man of few words. Let's see what he had to say after the fight.
No, I'm a gladiator, I'm just a warrior to the end, to the bitter end, and I'm just ready to go. You know, I want to go to the top level of this game and reach my full potential.
I mean, another warrior in there is Anthony Joshua, and let's dedicate a bit of time talking about him right now. Is this something that's gone wrong? Is it an age thing now at 34? He just doesn't have the chin or the pace or the power anymore? Because he really looked off it. He did look like he had lead in his legs last night at times.
Yeah, well, again, once you get caught with a big shot in that division, I've talked about that panic, it seeps into you, and then you're always trying to be reactive rather than proactive. And I think that's what it was. And I think he tried to box Dubai rather than try and really stamp his authority where he had taken a shot. So, you know, there is a few issues there, but, you know, in this division, once you get caught with a good shot, you know, you start to unravel, unfortunately. But I would say one thing, though, the first punch that knocked him down with that right hand was a fight finisher, and he got up.
Mm-hmm.
And the first punch and the last knockdown were fight finishing punches. Obviously, the last one was a genuine fight finisher, but he showed great resolve trying to get up when he couldn't get up. He tried to get up. You know, he showed great courage and resolve. But yeah, he's 34 years of age. It didn't seem like there was many miles on the clock. He can continue his career. I think he's still fresh enough and he's still good enough to beat a lot of heavyweights, and he might beat Dubois again. I wouldn't bet on it, to be fair, but he's good enough when he's right, when he's assertive. But the rebuild, will he be allowed that luxury of having a rebuild again? Will he want to do 2, 3, or 4 fights before he goes into a big fight? And should he go in with Dubois straight away? You would probably say that would be not a very wise move. So I don't know where he goes. And it's easy to say to people, he's been a 2-time heavyweight champion of the world. You know, he's a superstar. You know, he'll have those sponsorship brandings probably to the rest of his life anyway, because of who he is. And he's earned more money than he could ever spend in his lifetime and his family could spend and his generational wealth.
Mm.
But when you love the sport, when you love anything, it's hard to let it go because you're defined by what it is. What do you do then?
Yeah, and he's not going to want to go out like that, is he? You know, he's not ending at his peak. There are very few boxers that do end, but he's not going to want to end like that. But he has changed the sport, hasn't he? He's changed the sport of heavyweight boxing, particularly in the UK. You know, we're talking about every time he fights now, he'll fill Wembley. 90-odd thousand people there last night. Liam Gallagher as the opening act.
Yeah.
I mean, he's turned it into more than boxing. He's turned it into an event which people beyond boxing want to watch.
He's nowhere near the greatest heavyweight of all time. Let's just get that right. But for what he's done for the sport of boxing, especially in the UK, he made stadium fights feel the norm.
Yeah.
That's thinking, that's just madness.
Yeah.
And it is, though, isn't it?
And it was a glitz and glam that felt like it was from the 80s in the heavyweight world, didn't it? We hadn't had that excitement around heavyweights for many, many years.
No, but look, and even I go back to when he beat Klitschko, and I say that, you know, the speech after the fight was almost as good as the speech itself. Every aspiring boxer would have been down that gym the next day. Yeah. I almost went down the gym. I never, because I'm too old. But I mean, I was inspired by this. It was just, he did everything right. What you want from a heavyweight champion of the world, from an idol, from a hero. He's been fantastic for the sport. He has. And he's had his trials and tribulations, but I think, he's been an asset, and the heavyweight division, when that's healthy, it trickles down to all other weights. As little guys, we all benefit from it, and we all benefit. All the boxers benefited from Anthony Joshua being who he was and how good he was. So, he can never be forgotten. I don't even know if we ever see that. We'll see better fighters for sure, but I don't know if we'll ever see anyone with the influence that he's had over the sport in Britain. Maybe never.
We're not writing him off just yet, but just finally, Tyson Fury, he's been doing the rounds in what is now a viral clip of him shouting, "He's just cost me 150 million quid." That fight's never going to happen now, is it? Or if it does, it certainly wouldn't have been the event it would have been a couple of years ago.
No, I mean, it'd be a more intriguing fight, I think, because they both show vulnerabilities. I think Tyson Fury has declined, I think. But that fight with Usyk was close, so he could get the win. If he gets the win, then I think the fight with him and Joshua is further away and probably will never happen. But if he doesn't win, and with the money that's around nowadays and the influence of people that can make that fight happen, that might very well happen as a goodbye to everyone, for both of them. Maybe. But who knows? If it doesn't happen, it'd be a travesty to the sport, because they have been the two biggest names in British boxing and arguably world boxing for the last sort of 10, 15 years on and off between both of them. So for them not to fight each other, because in the geographically how close they are, would be a sad thing. But it's funny how the sport works. They were both at the top of the tree. We couldn't get it made. And now they're both maybe in a position where they might have to retire possibly at the end of the road. And we might just get to see it on the wrong end of their careers. But
yeah, we'd still want to watch it.
It's a crazy sport we're in, yeah.
We'd still watch it, wouldn't we?
We would.
Barry, great to chat to you. Thank you ever so much for your time tonight.
You take care, John. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Top guy, Barry Jones there, former WBO super featherweight world champion and a regular contributor to Five Lives Boxing Podcast. I think Jeff's on the line now. Should we talk boxing with Jeff? Hiya, Jeff. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? How are you? All right.
Yeah,
all right.
Very good, thank you. What did you make of last night? Did you watch it live, or did you listen to it on Five Live?
I listened to it on Five Live.
Good man.
Yeah, listened to it on Five Live. Enjoyed it. Yeah.
Good man. What did you think going into it? Did you doubt Daniel Dubois? Did you think
no,
that this was AJ's?
No.
Right. Okay.
No. I've got my doubts about AJ. I thought he's a dangerous. He's 27, and Joshua's 34, much younger man. I think there's a bit of Mike Tyson about Daniel Dubois, I just thought they didn't show him the respect he deserved, He's the champion. Whatever they say, he's got the belt. And they made him do the ring walk first. I've never known that. I've never been a boxing fan all my life. The champion always comes in second, And they made Daniel Dubois do the ring walk first, and then I think Joshua should have come in first. But he's 27 and he's hungry, and I called you Friday night, and I've predicted it. I called it Friday night. If you look back at the records, I thought to Bob I knockout, and I've been proved right. I've run my boxing all my life, and just thought he's hungry, And he's a humble guy.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a good night for boxing.
Well,
do you know
what he is? He's a man of few words, isn't he? Which is always a bit of an issue in boxing, because people love people running their mouths. They love the showboating.
I thought it was an Eddie Hearn production last night,
Yeah.
96,000. I think 95,800 was Joshua fans.
Oh, they were. Yeah, there was
maybe more.
A massive weight to the fan. Yeah, you're
making
right
him do making him do the ring walk first. I don't like that. I mean, he got the belt. you know, a bit disrespect. That might have set him up, you know. That might have fired him up.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you saw any of the face-to-faces before, and they were getting very tetchy, and at one point Dubois and Anthony Joshua squaring off to one another. You know, and Anthony Joshua is a big character. Dubois is obviously a big character, but much quieter.
Well, I caught a bit with my mate, you know, on his phone and that, but, you know, yeah. But I listened to it on 5 Live, you know. What do you think
happens next for Joshua?
Well, I don't like to say really, but he's 34 now, you know. Yeah. Well, I don't really care, I have to say, you know, I think he's been heavily hyped by Eddie Hearn, you know, and I don't think he's had it for a few years, you know. He lost to Usyk twice, and he's had a couple of comeback fights, but against not strong contenders, you know. And I think Dubois has fought better challengers. Mm. And I don't know what to say about Joshua, you know. I think he's been a bit comforted, you know. He's been a bit padded, really. And, you know, I just don't think he's got it. Well, it's between the ears as well, you know. And I don't know if I'm saying too much, but... He does seem to have it mentally, you know. He seems to struggle. I mean, I don't know what to say really about Joshua.
Well, I think
I'm a boxing fan, but you know, I don't know where he goes from here. You know, and I don't really care. I think Tyson Fury's is very inactive. You know, he's inactive.
Yeah,
I've been a boxing fan all my life. You know.
Well, the sad reality is, you know, there was, as ever, it was ego, money and agents that prevented, I would say, that fight from happening when they were both in their prime. And the reality is that the fans were the ones that missed out because of those three reasons. And I think it's really sad. I think that fight from speaking to Barry Jones a moment ago, that fight could still happen because it will be a massive payday. But I think the fans have been prevented from watching that fight at its peak, sadly.
The trouble is, you've got up and coming heavyweights now.
Yeah.
I mean, Dubois, he's only 27, 7 years younger than AJ.
But you've got the thing with Anthony Joshua, you've got the ability to fill an arena.
He's 39 now, eh? Tyson Fury, you know.
Yeah, they'd still fill an
arena. They're inactive,
though.
But it happened years ago. Yeah. They used to pick their fights years ago, you know, the heavyweights. And Mike Weaver and that, he used to pick his fights. He was inactive for years, you know.
That's the problem.
Couple of years. Good fighters, but they used to pick him. They used to pick him years ago.
Yeah.
But,
all right, Jeff.
You know, but he's up, he's hungry now, Dubois, and yeah.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
I think the times are gone now. Just AJ and Fury. I think they've just let it slip.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Too inactive.
I think you're right. I think it still might happen, but I think it's sadly past its best before. Listen, nice to talk to you, Jeff. Take care.
Well, I might fight, but it will be for a world title, I don't think.
I know, it'll just be for 150 million quid instead. But, you know, which would you rather? Jeff, thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, Paul's in York. Evening to you, Paul. How are you?
Hiya, mate. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, nice to have you on. What would you like to talk about?
It was when Dr. Travis, Sarah Jarvis, that was on.
Yeah.
When she was saying about GP surgeries.
Mm.
And I tried to get through while she was on air, because I think it's about time somebody explained to us why all of a sudden our surgeries are having these massive long waiting times, 4 to 6 weeks at our surgery to get an appointment. Unless you're on death's door, and then they just tell you to call 111 or go down to A&E. But why are they all of a sudden? Because we call in there quite a bit to pick bloods up, specimens and things like that. There's never anybody in waiting rooms.
Well, the argument is that they don't have the staff. That there's a shortage of GPs, which makes it really difficult to keep up with the level of the appointments, and I think that a lot of GPs have left the service or have gone at least down to part-time because they couldn't keep up with the workload.
The whole system, I mean, it's like Labour coming in and saying they're going to do this, they're going to do that. To be honest, I don't think there's a party amongst any political groups that really, really want to save the NHS. I think they want rid of it because it's a burden to them. I mean, I'm a taxi driver. I spend more time doing account work for NHS. I sometimes think I'm employed by NHS rather than being a self-employed taxi driver.
Really? And who pays for you then, Paul? How does it work?
NHS pay for it. I have to be careful what I say.
Yeah, just keep it general. Yeah, keep it general.
But they think nothing to sending our cars out at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning with patients' notes from one hospital to another, York to Scarborough or vice versa, or taking staff backwards and forwards.
So you are what? So you're not necessarily picking up patients. A hospital might want to take some notes across to another of a patient, and they'd book you to do it.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, it's all on account. And there's also exactly. There's also 999 work. Now, since when do you ring an ambulance and expect to get a taxi turn up?
Really? So you're turning up to someone's house that what might have had a heart attack or something?
Well, we're not supposed to get category ones or twos.
Right.
But we do get them occasionally.
Goodness me.
It's scary. I mean, all you've got is your basic training, first aid training.
Yeah, that must be terrifying for you. Listen, Paul, I'm just conscious of time, but thank you for calling. I didn't expect to hear that taxi drivers taking people to hospital on 999 calls.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Charlotte Simpson. President Biden has said the United States is pushing hard to prevent a wider war in the Middle East. Egypt had already warned that intensifying fighting between Israel and Lebanon's Iranian-backed Hezbollah risked igniting a regional conflict. Cross-border attacks killed at least 3 people in Lebanon, and thousands of others in northern Israel have been seeking shelter from incoming missiles. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned Hezbollah against further strikes.
They haven't stopped for a single day attacking us. No country can accept the wanton rocketing of its cities. We can't accept it either. We will take whatever action is necessary to restore security and to bring our people safe back to their homes.
In a speech at the Labour Party conference, the Chancellor will promise a budget to rebuild Britain as the party comes under scrutiny on the issue of donations, including holidays and clothing. The Prime Minister has said that senior ministers will not accept gifts of clothes in the future. Our political editor, Chris Mason, says Labour MPs and members are hoping Rachel Reeves' speech will draw a line under the row.
There's a real hunger here, a real desire for this party in government to crack on with doing stuff after years of being starved of that because they kept losing elections. And also, as I say, trying to move on from the bumpiness of the last couple of weeks.
A second man has been arrested in connection with the kidnap of an 87-year-old man in Oldham. The pensioner was reportedly dragged into a car and attacked as he was being driven around while demands were made for his money. He was eventually dumped in West Yorkshire. Sri Lanka's presidential election has been won by the left-wing opposition candidate, Anura Kumarasinghe. The poll, which went to a second count for the first time in Sri Lanka's history, was described as one of the country's closest. He's promised voters tough anti-corruption measures and to revive the economy. Samir Hussain is in Colombo.
It's a complete shift away from the political dynasty of the Rajapaksas that have really